Today's meeting is called Global Turmoil, the Rise of Trumpism and the Contradictions. No, it's not it, is it? Multiple crises, excuse me. The multiple crises of contemporary capitalism. And our guest speaker today is Jordan from Toronto, who's a member of the International Bolshevik Tendency, graduate of Brock University as well, some years ago. And Jordan will be presenting an analysis informed by his the politics of the IBT, which are Trotskyist politics. So what we're going to do is have a presentation of, 30 or 40 minutes, approximately?
I would say more like 30.
30? Okay.
Yeah.
And followed by discussion period, question and answer and comments. Okay. I'll explain the rules of the discussion period when we get to that phase of the meeting. So I'll turn things over to Jordan.
Okay. Thanks, Murray. Okay. So as everyone is well aware, the election of Donald Trump marks an important turning point in American politics. He has wasted no time in composing a cabinet of billionaires, generals, and assorted reactionaries to push through a program of brutal austerity on behalf of the corporate ruling class. In the first month of Trump's administration, he has sought to impose his infamous Muslim ban, which targets 7 majority Muslim nations, all of whom the U.S. has either invaded, bombed, or sanctioned. He's pushed ahead with plans to expand the wall along the U.S.-Mexican border, threatened to deport millions of undocumented immigrants, and taken aim at so-called sanctuary cities, threatening to cut off federal funding if local police forces don't act as federal immigration agents. He's ordered government agencies to expedite approval of the Dakota Access and Keystone XL pipelines, dismissing opposition by environmentalists and Native Americans, while gagging the EPA employees from making any public criticisms. Trump has feted the Wall Street elite that he once railed against in his campaign, and rolled back regulations on bankers and brokers enacted after the 2008 financial meltdown. And of course, most recently this week, he proposed cutting 10% from spending on social services and government regulations, things like education, transportation, labor, housing, and agriculture, and instead proposes to redirect it towards the military and the police. Now, much attention has been given to the ostensibly fascist character of Trump, elements within his administration, and those that support him. And no doubt his America First xenophobia has emboldened neo-Nazis and a variety of white nationalist and alt-right scum in the U.S. And while Trump shares some of the characteristics traditionally associated with fascist dictators, such as anti-immigrant bigotry and nativism, male chauvinist bravado, and appeals to the downtrodden with economic protectionism and promises to make America great again, he is operating within the framework of bourgeois legality, and he lacks an organized mass movement of extra-parliamentary thugs, which is an essential element and feature of fascism. Writing about the rise of fascism in Germany in the 1930s, Leon Trotsky made the following observation. Quote, "Fascism is a particular governmental system based on the uprooting of all elements of proletarian democracy within bourgeois society. When a state turns fascist, the workers' organizations are annihilated. The proletariat is reduced to an amorphous state. And a system of administration is created which penetrates deeply into the masses and which serves to frustrate the independent crystallization of the proletariat." Just a brief point on terminology. Proletariat, for those that are unfamiliar, refers to the working class. And bourgeois society, or bourgeois, refers to those that are capitalists. So Trotsky's characterization does not accurately represent and characterize Trumpism today, nor what's happening in the U.S. Despite the fact that Trump is a despicable misogynist and a vulgar billionaire who pretends to champion the interests of millions of white middle Americans, he has channeled that discontent in a right-wing populist and not fascist direction. A similar phenomenon is taking place throughout Europe, where right-wing populism, economic nationalism, and anti-immigrant bigotry are all on the rise. In Britain, the increase in support for the UK Independence Party, or UKIP, along with the Leave vote in the referendum on Brexit last June, both represent unprecedented levels of disillusionment with the traditional parties of British imperialism. In Holland, the anti-immigrant Freedom Party of Geert Wilders was, until recently, leading in the polls for the general election, which takes place in 2 weeks in Holland. And in France, which has always been seen as one of the key pillars to the project for an integrated capitalist Europe, Marine Le Pen's far-right National Front currently leads in the polls for the presidential elections, which take place in April. At bottom, Trump's election and the resistance that he's received from wide layers of the U.S. establishment represents the division within the ruling class over how best to arrest and prevent the United States' declining status as global hegemon. Trump represents that wing of the bourgeoisie that wants a fundamental rejigging of the world order and is willing to overhaul the institutions that were created at the outset of the American century after World War II. The UN, the IMF, the World Bank, and particularly NATO. The unprecedented reluctance from the leadership of the military-industrial complex and the deep state intelligence agencies, the NSA, the CIA, and the FBI, to consolidate around Trump is motivated by an attempt to pressure the White House to stay the course that for generations both Republicans and Democrats had adhered to. This is the root of the current, the root of the anti-Russia campaign currently gripping Washington, and of course embraced by the corporate media. The recent removal of Michael Flynn as the National Security Advisor and his replacement with McMaster, H.R. McMaster, is designed to signal a more aggressive policy towards Russia. The new National Security Advisor, McMaster, is a proponent of conventional going-in-big warfare and recently headed up an initiative known as the Russia New Generation Warfare Study, which was designed to reorient the U.S. military toward confrontation with Moscow. And recently, it now appears that Attorney General Jeff Sessions might not survive either, allegedly for having the same undisclosed communication with the same Russian ambassador that prompted Flynn to be removed. Today, the United States has a chain of military bases that span from the oil fields of formerly Soviet Central Asia through Afghanistan to the Persian Gulf. In Europe, which is NATO's eastern flank, which stretches from the Baltic states down to the Black Sea, is being prepared for armed confrontation with Moscow. Poland, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia have thousands of NATO combat troops, battle tanks, heavy artillery, drones, attack helicopters, and warplanes deployed within their borders. All of them are within striking distance of Russia. According to The Nation, which is America's leading liberal weekly publication, this is a quote. All of this, the aggressive exercises, the NATO buildup, the added U.S. troop deployments, this reflects a new and dangerous strategic outlook in Washington. Until recently, American forces had largely been primed to defeat insurgent and irregular forces such as the Taliban in Afghanistan. Now, however, the Pentagon is being readied for a return to great power competition, including the possibility of all-out combat with high-end enemies like Russia and China. End quote. So this deep state bureaucracy is alarmed by Trump's unpredictability, his criticism of NATO's ability to further American interests, and his supposed conciliatory attitude towards Russia. Its campaign to destabilize the administration is an attempt to maintain control over the key security and intelligence posts and effectively guide foreign policy. It also illustrates the Marxist understanding that at its core, the capitalist state is an instrument of repression in the hands of the ruling class. When you strip away the elections that we have every few years and the democratic facades, what remains is the police, the army, and the security apparatus that call the shots. For Trump, in order to avoid resignation, impeachment, or something worse, he has to have the cooperation of this deep state, which will allow him to gain control over American economic, foreign, and military policy. The U.S. today is an empire in decline. It is a society that combines incredible concentration of wealth in the hands of a tiny few, along with very limited social mobility for the masses. Levels of social inequality in America have now reached unprecedented levels, with an immense transfer of wealth from Main Street to Wall Street over the last several decades, rooted in a profitability crisis that began in the late 60s and the early 1970s. A recent report by radical liberal economist Thomas Piketty noted that the share of national income for the bottom half of Americans has fallen from 20% in 1970 to 12% in 2014. During that same period, the share for the poorest 90% of Americans, that is 9 out of 10, those income earners dropped from 66% to 53%. And it is only the top 10% that have seen life get easier over the last 45 years. The 1% now takes home 20% of national income, while the next 9%, a term that refers to those that have a net worth of between $1 million and $8 million, those people now earn 27% of national income. But it's really at the apex of this pyramid of wealth and power that you need to look to find this truly super rich and what's been going on in the United States over the last 40 years or so. The top 0.1%. Now, according to Salon.com, quote, the 0.1%, or the top tenth of a percent, now owns about as much wealth as the bottom 90% of Americans combined. And that's just the official numbers. To get into that club, you need to start with a nest egg of $20 million. And that is at the very bottom of the super rich group. George W. Bush, former president, just barely makes the cut. Now, as you move up that ladder of the 0.1%, you also get bankers and CEOs like Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan Chase and Carly Fiorina, formerly of Hewlett-Packard. And by 2015, the wealthiest 20 people owned more wealth than half the American population. That's roughly about the size of this group here tonight. 20 people own more wealth than half the American population. This group is where you'll find Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook and Larry Page of Google, as well as the most successful financiers like Warren Buffett and George Soros. That's the end of the quote. Now, a similar report by Richard Reeves, who is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, which is a Washington, D.C.-based think tank, concluded the following. Quote, America is becoming a more class-stratified society. This separation of the upper middle class by income, wealth, occupation, and neighborhood has created a social distance between those of us who have been prospering in recent decades, and those who are feeling left behind, angry and resentful, and more likely to vote for it to hell with them all populist politicians, like Donald Trump. End quote. Now, years of declining trade union rates, stagnating wages, mounting debt, and no serious fight back by the leadership of the labor movement have all contributed to the rise of Trumpism. At bottom, Trumpism is a product of the decay of bourgeois politics under capitalism. And the groundwork for it has been laid by decades of Republican and Democratic administrations. During the 8 years that Obama occupied the White House, he carried out a wholesale assault on those that he pretended to represent. Millions of families lost their home and homes through foreclosure, while the banks that created the housing bubble got government bailouts. Under Obama, 2.5 million immigrants were deported. And that's more than all of their presidents combined. And Obama also oversaw the expansion of U.S. imperialism's global war on terror, including a $1 trillion nuclear weapons modernization program. Freelance journalist John Pilger recently provided what I think is a fairly accurate summary of the foreign policy legacy that Obama leaves behind after 2 terms in office. Again, this is a fairly lengthy quote, but it's a good one. Quote, Barack Obama expanded America's favorite military pastime, bombing and death squads, special operations, as no other president has done since the Cold War. According to Council on Foreign Relations survey, in 2016 alone, Obama dropped 26,171 bombs. That's 72 bombs every day. He bombed the poorest people on earth. Pardon me. He bombed the poorest people on earth in Afghanistan, Libya, Yemen, Somalia, Syria, Iraq, and Pakistan. It's a powerful quote. Every Tuesday, according to the New York Times, he personally selected those who would be murdered by mostly hellfire missiles fired from drones. Weddings, funerals, and shepherds were attacked, along with those attempting to collect the body parts festooning the terrorist target. And under Obama, the U.S. has extended secret special forces operations to 138 countries, or 70% of the world's population. And it was Obama who placed missiles in Eastern Europe aimed at Russia. And it was this winner of the Nobel Peace Prize who increased spending on nuclear warheads to a level higher than that of any administration since the Cold War. That's the end of the quote. Now, in the lead up to the election last November, Hillary Clinton was presented as the stable, rational, and progressive choice to that of Trump, and a continuation of the policies under Obama. But despite posturing as a friend of blacks, women, immigrants, and working people, her campaign was firmly committed to maintaining the status quo. We noted before the election that Clinton's top contributors include J.P. Morgan Chase and Company, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Time Warner, and Bank of America. She is on record as supporting practically every crime committed by U.S. imperialism in the recent past. She supported the murderous assault of Iraq, or on Iraq, in 2003, as well as the subsequent occupation. As Secretary of State, she backed the military junta that overthrew the democratically elected government of Manuel Zelaya in Honduras in 2009. Clinton was also the architect of the criminal NATO assault on Libya in 2011 that destroyed what was once the most prosperous country on the African continent. She's an ardent defender of Israeli apartheid and has bragged about U.S. capacity to, quote, totally obliterate Iran. She has also been an advocate of regime change in Syria and arming the jihadi rebels fighting Bashar al-Assad. Now, after democratic, quote-unquote, socialist Bernie Sanders rose to national prominence on the strength of his denunciation of Clinton's affinity for Wall Street and the billionaire class, emails published by WikiLeaks revealed how the Democratic Party establishment actively sought to sabotage his campaign. Despite the fact that the polls consistently showed that Sanders was more likely to beat Trump than Clinton, the Democratic machine opted for the former warmongering Secretary of State, who failed to even excite proponents of liberal identity politics. And while Sanders put forward a series of limited but supportable reforms during the campaign, such as raising the minimum wage, free college tuition, he's also on record as having backed NATO's bombing of Serbia in 1999, as well as the imperialist assault on Afghanistan in 2001. He supported U.S. airstrikes against ISIS in Syria and Iraq, and has threatened sanctions against Iran. And of course, since the election, Sanders has joined other Democrats in confirming Trump's cabinet picks, including his nominees for Secretary of Defense, General James Mad Dog Mattis, as well as the head of Homeland Security, General John Kelly. Presumably, Sanders or another sufficiently polished progressive candidate will step into the spotlight in 2020 and restore the tarnished credentials of the Democrats after Clinton's complete failure. The U.S. establishment is deeply concerned that Trump, right now, is politicizing wide layers of society and encouraging a possible and potential left-wing radicalization. The wave of protest against Trump's war on immigrants and the oppressed indicates the level of anger towards the administration's program of reaction and repression. U.S. veterans have stood in solidarity with climate activists and the Native community at Standing Rock in opposition to the Dakota Access Pipeline. Thousands of demonstrators showed up at JFK International Airport in January to protest the detainment of refugees and visitors from the countries blocked by Trump's Muslim ban. Last month, workers organized a day without immigrants to highlight the importance of immigrant labor to the U.S. economy and to oppose Trump's plans to extend the border wall between the U.S. and Mexico and deport potentially millions of undocumented immigrants. 4.5 million people attended the Women's March on Washington throughout the U.S., while some 60,000 or more came out in Toronto. And on Inauguration Day, members of Local 10 of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, dockers on the West Coast, they shut down the largest container terminal in Oakland, California, to protest Trump's reactionary policies. Now, while small in scope, actions like these are glimmers of hope of what is possible If the multiracial working class was to mobilize on a class struggle program to oppose Trump and defend the oppressed. But ultimately, a successful fight for climate justice or indigenous rights, full citizenship rights for immigrants, women's liberation or the right to organize trade unions and so on, must ultimately be linked to the need for revolutionary change and a rejection of the reformist notion that the task of would-be leaders of the workers' movement is to make recommendations on which of the two or three poisons is least toxic come election time. The campaigns of left-talking liberal hustlers like Bernie Sanders only channel discontent back into the existing political framework, and they add momentum to a rightward shift of American politics that, over the past 40 years, has narrowed the space between the two twin parties of U.S. imperialism to the point where they are virtually indistinguishable. Now, unfortunately, a number of self-styled Marxist groups spent the pre-election period either openly backing Sanders or calling on him to break from the Democrats and run as an independent. The most prominent were Socialist Alternative, which is associated with Seattle City Councilor Kishama Sawant, as well as the International Socialist Organization, both of whom originally supported Sanders' political revolution against the billionaire class. Sawant and Socialist Alternative went so far as to launch a movement for Bernie, which, in their own words, would, quote, build an organized political force behind the Sanders campaign to fight against racism, sexism, and corporate domination, end quote. When it was clear that Sanders would be voting for Clinton and would not be running as an independent, both those groups, Socialist Alternative and the ISO, ended up jumping ship and backing Green Party candidate Jill Stein. The International Marxist Tendency, or the IMT, which is led by a man named Alan Woods, in the U.S. they're known as Socialist Appeal, and here in Canada they're known as Fight Back. They're actually the largest left group in Toronto. They hoped that Sanders would break from the Democrats and run an independent socialist campaign. Now, this fantasy was supposed to be the first step on the way to establishing what for them was, quote, the basis of a mass socialist party in the USA. A party of the working class. This will mean a new stage in the fight for socialism and for a government of, by, and for the working class. That's what they thought Sanders' campaign could become. There should be nothing surprising about Sanders' endorsement of Clinton and his refusal to break with the Democrats. They are both the inevitable and logical result of his loyalty to the capitalist social order. The Sanders campaign was never designed to be a springboard to American social democracy, like an American NDP party, let alone a genuinely socialist workers' movement for revolutionary change. The unwillingness of socialist groups like Socialist Alternative, the ISO, and IMT to say this simple truth only sows illusions that pro-capitalist politicos like Sanders can somehow be turned into agents of fundamental change. Capitalism is a cancer that, left unchecked, will ultimately destroy human society. And Trump is merely the latest tumorous outgrowth. And while he's already helped demystify and discredit the office of the presidency, and his tenure seems likely to accelerate the decline of the traditional institutions of U.S. imperialism, capitalism itself will not disappear on its own. It must be uprooted and replaced with a higher socialist form of economic organization. The development of the consciousness necessary for working people to carry out this task must begin with the assertion of the absolute independence from the political agencies of the exploiters, whether they be Democrats, Greens, or another third-party pro-capitalist dead end. Only a socialist planned economy organized on a global scale can lift the majority of humanity out of the poverty, the hunger, and the disease to which the market has consigned them. The objective interests of working people and the oppressed stand in stark opposition to a society based on the pursuit of private profit. Our interests, the interests of working people, can only find political expression through the creation of a mass revolutionary party based on a program of wholesale expropriation of capital and the reorganization of society according to the principle that those who work must rule. The key task for revolutionaries in this period must be to struggle to cohere the nucleus of a new Bolshevik-type party based on the political heritage of Lenin and Trotsky, which is a tradition that our organization obviously identifies with, and committed to fight for leadership of North America's powerful workers' movement. This is the revolutionary perspective upon which the IBT is based and for which we fight. Thank you.